Good morning. Today is Friday. Inauguration Day. I didn't realize today was the 20th was also the first Martin Luther King holiday.
Mm-hmm.
Way back. It started, yeah.
Way back.
Yeah.
Yep.
Joining
Good
us this morning, yes, Karen Deemer from the city of Alcata. Our quote this morning comes from, let's see if we can find a fun one here. Aeneas Nin, is that how you pronounce her name? A-N-A with the umlauts. I-S.
Ani?
I've seen it all over the place.
The
I've never.
Silent.
Yeah. Quote, life shrinks or expands in proportion to one's courage.
Seems like an apropos that, quote
yeah,
for today.
Yeah. Finally got one right. Oh, my. So you guys did something this week. What was it at the council meeting?
A couple of things at the council. One, we expanded. So we have the medical cannabis innovation zone, you know, where we're looking at permitting various, some cultivation, but predominantly manufacturing and sort of value-added products. We had a cap of 4 permits in a majority of that zone, and our planning commission in December issued the 4th use permit for that. So the council revisited that cap and raise that cap to 20 to give a couple of years of buffer probably for property owners out in that area that were interested in coming in and applying for a use permit to be in the cannabis industry. So it's still a very regulated industry in Arcata and even within that industrial zone, but it does allow people to come forward with plans. And still has that checkpoint of going through the planning commission, so the neighbors immediately surrounding that business would be noticed and have the ability to come forth and talk about any concerns that they have.
The banking industry and the delivery industry and a bunch of those folks are running into the fact that marijuana is still illegal.
On the federal level, yeah.
With the activities that in California and the other states are dealing with in trying to anticipate, deal with the legalization, recreational and medicinal. Are the cities at risk at all? I mean, you get federal funding. And I suppose you could actually talk about sanctuary city being the same thing too, but this being the topic, are you at risk for any funding at the federal level because you are doing illegal from their definition?
Federal activities, yeah. We have tried to align our programs with the current stance of the federal government. Now, of course, as of today, that could be changing. So we'll continue to watch that sort of playing field and see. So what we had suggested in a staff level to the council, because a lot of questions have come up post Prop 64 and the legalization of non-medical use, what Arcata did was we could talk about right after the break.
Ooh, you know how to do that like a pro. It's 8:19.
You've never heard us before because we're something brand new. It's called Destination Radio. If you live in Ferndale or Gold Beach, Blue Lake or Klamath, Brookings or Eureka, you'll be looking for someplace different to take the family, something special to do next weekend. The best destinations for day trips and overnights, for hiking or biking, for beachcombing or birdwatching, and you'll turn to us for ideas, because you're the reason we're here, to help you find your close-to-home destination. Stay, play, and relax with us. Destination Radio.
Good morning, KINS, News and Information Time. It's 8:24. We're back to Talk Shop this morning with Karen Deemer. Oh, you don't want to know what I wrote down. We had that other conversation. You don't want to be the education secretary, do you?
I got pretty close there for you.
Yeah, okay. So kind of clean that one up. Oh, boy. You were talking a little bit before the break about the permitting process and some of the changes that are going on. In Eureka, I know there's significant changes in the commercial areas mm-hmm. because there's an opportunity to realize more money with certain occupants than sure. the current occupants. Yeah. So they're doing a lot of relocating efforts. How's that for being nice?
That's a little bit more roundabout. I can probably be a little bit more direct.
I bet you could.
Because it was really a concern of our community and our council. And when we looked at a very large industrial sector, has a couple of old mill sites out off of West End Road. There are a lot of sort of dilapidated infrastructure that's very expensive to try to rehab. And we've been looking for an industry since the timber industry went, you know, sort of out of business in that region anyway, that has that level of money to infuse in that very expensive properties. So there is opportunity, I think, with the cannabis industry for some of that rehab of these old industrial spaces.
What about the old Beaver site?
On Simone Boulevard?
Yeah, I mean, why would you want to have a district instead of having a couple of different locations so it isn't so concentrated?
Right. For the reason that Arcata really chose to start small, start slow, and allow things to grow. It doesn't mean that the council won't consider other
but
sites.
But the 4 to 20, that isn't a physicalness. That's just a number of permits.
That's just a number of permits still within that West End Road Innovation Zone. Because what we saw originally, the cap was 4, which was a very low number. For the reason I think you're just alluding to is that we have a very successful niche manufacturing industry in the West End Road, Alder Grove area, and we didn't want to see that pushed out by higher rents. So over the last 9 months since we've been starting to operate in this zone with cannabis, we've watched its very slow growth. You know, the concept of being able to get your permit to cultivate or manufacture cannabis is fairly easy, but the actual construction of the infrastructure that you need, whether it's a building or the extraction equipment, or, you know, you've got to go through that entire construction process, and that takes time, especially with these properties that have existing old dilapidated buildings that can be even, you know, a longer process and more expensive to renovate.
Are the buildings the only issue, or is there also contamination? Because didn't, when Terry Farmer, didn't the DA go
years ago,
in
we
there
had
with
what we
some
call
kind of environmental
the LP
something?
Settlement
yeah.
on that area. And so that LP settlement, I think, you know, maintained and cleaned up most of the area, the constituents of concern. We are actually on another project, more on creek restoration and creek enhancement project, working with a number of agencies to review that area again and see if there's any legacy load that we could bring some grant money to and try to help with.
Legacy load. That, yeah. Now, that sounds like a governmental phrase, doesn't it? Oh, boy. Once you guys also had the thing with the butane.
We did.
Which I kind of... I understand, but initially it's like, now there's another burden on business to document something that is a legal sale.
Right.
Cost for business because somebody doesn't like how something's being used. I mean, that kind of, that opens a door for a whole bunch of interesting potentials down the road.
It might. This one seems to be fairly extreme in our North Coast. I mean, the number of injuries and specific health and safety concerns over butane explosions that can not only take out your kitchen, but your neighbor's kitchen and your, that neighbor's kitchen.
The whole
and,
block,
you know,
yeah.
And the increase that we've seen, the increase in size of the containers of butane that are starting to be purchased in this area was only going to magnify that. So both Eureka and Arcata at this point have done some sales restrictions on butane. We recognize that that is just a baby step. We recognize people can still go online and purchase them and they can be delivered. Whether or not having to put in a physical address and a credit card that links you to something, you know, somehow detours people from shopping for butane online. But communities throughout California that have instituted restrictions on butane sales have started to see a reduction in two things. One, the explosion rate. But two, just the environmental degradation of these canisters being left. I mean, hundreds of thousands of canisters. You've probably seen some of the pictures of ravines 6 feet deep full of canisters of these in Humboldt County. So this is a pretty extreme example of one particular product creating health and safety and environmental hazard in this entire region.
Now, my understanding is like a nano, right? Okay. But the larger units, the more expensive units to do what I guess is now a legal process. with the hash oils, if it's in the right place and the permits and
sure. Other,
use larger canisters. It would have seemed to me that if the attempt was to avoid the exploding house syndrome,
mm-hmm.
that you wouldn't allow size containers below a certain level that don't fit the little cheapy, that only work for the larger ones, the ones that are permitted, the ones that are in the chemistry labs inside these facilities.
Right.
Was that even discussed?
It was considered. There are okay. still some small legitimate uses of butane, you know, filling up lighters. Some people still use butane for camping stoves. So to have one or two of these canisters, you know, on your possession for that type of activity, we didn't want to completely restrict.
KINS News and Information Time, it's 8:30.
We do as a community to make Humboldt a better place to work and live? The answer is to make sure our kids are literate, able to plan financially, move forward in their education so they are better prepared to enter our workforce, and become contributing and productive members in our society, community, and economy. How do we do it? Through the Decade of Difference Initiative. Visit decadeofdifference.org and find out how you, as a parent, student, or business owner, can help. It's the Decade of Difference. Be part of it.
Good morning, KINS News and Information Time. It's 8:35. We're back to Talk Shop this morning with Karen Diemer, Arcata City Manager. Talk Shop presented this morning by CDH Painting and by REDEC. Karen, the governor came out with his budget on the 10th. I understand it was kind of like, okay, flat. Fair enough. When you saw it, and coming from the perspective of small town, or, pardon me,
right.
Small city.
City, yeah.
Yes. I get the difference. What was your initial impression with this?
Our initial impression, and that we have not read in detail, you know, all of the parts, but really what we expected to see. You know, we're not going to see a lot of change from the state level, and we don't get a lot of money directly from the state at this point. We were thankful it doesn't appear as though they're going to be making a reach or a grab for additional local revenues to go back to the state. So status quo for us was a positive step.
Is there any fear that there's going to be more, boy, here's the cost shifting,
mm-hmm.
where the state steps back, but the city continues to have the obligation?
At this point, I'm not seeing that outlined in this upcoming year's budget. You know, we are seeing some additional shifting, not surprising, in the retirement, in the PERS retirement piece. The governor put in full pension reform several years ago. We are starting to see some of the benefits of that. But then the retirement system has just come out saying they're changing their investment assumptions and more realistically assessing what they thought their interest rate would be. And therefore, their revenues are less than they expected, so that all of the state and cities that are participatory in that will have to...
Cost shift
hey. Back to the cities. So we'll figure out how we can weather that for the next couple of years.
For folks who are unaware, why should the city have any responsibility in what an employee's group does with their investments and whether they're successful or whether they're not?
The simplified version of that is that the higher interest rate that those money managers make with that investment dollar, the less contributions the employee and the employer, being the cities or the state government in this situation, have to make. So, I mean, it operates very simple to Social Security. Everybody pays in during the duration of, you know, their work life, and then there's a benefit that's paid out after work. The idea is that there's additional people in the workforce that continue to pay into that benefit to support the retirees that then are receiving the benefit. So the higher interest rate, the more money available to pay out, and the less it costs those that are working to be in the system.
If they exceed the number, whatever the number is, do the cities and the counties get relief? Or does that just go as an extra, hey, it was a good year, to those retirees receiving benefits during that period?
It probably should have historically been placed in a reserve for the rainy day fund. Unfortunately, historically, that didn't happen. There was a period of time in what we call PERS, the Public Employees Retirement System, where cities and the state were called superfunded, where interest rates were high, where returns were good, for whatever reason, that the pool of retirees were not, you know, taking as much benefit as they anticipated would be paid out. And so there was a period of time we saw a reduction in rates, or what we saw a lot of cities do was increase the benefit package, so that while they were negotiating with their employees, instead of offering raises, they offered additional retirement incentives, because the accounts looked as though that money would be there to pay for that.
Forever and ever?
Forever and ever. Yeah. Well, obviously in 2008, 2009, 2010, we saw that that wasn't the case. So as the markets plummeted, all of these now enhanced retirement packages were in place contractually, no longer funded. The word superfund, I don't think, will ever be used again in the public employees retirement system world. And then pension reform came out of Jerry Brown.
So there was a compounded hammer.
Yeah.
That you guys got less money and more money being allocated
right.
in these areas.
Right.
Where do those lines cross with the Reformation that happened, or you know, with the new contracts you guys are signing with people,
mm-hmm.
what they're getting today is vastly different than what they got yesterday.
Right.
Where does that nexus happen?
All predictions were at about the 7-year mark. But now we've seen that, you know, they then look at, let's readjust our investment, you know, strategy. And it looks like our rate of return over the last 20 years isn't what we thought it was going to be consistently, so we need to adjust that down. In 10 years, they're going to look at life expectancy, and they're going to say, wow, all of a sudden everybody's living 3 more years. And we only funded everybody to 85, and now the average is 87. So there are constant moving parts when you're managing retirement packages.
Does it ever benefit the taxpayer? or it seems like everything's pushing out so that there's more and more and a higher percentage of your budget, the school's budget, the county's budget,
yeah.
going to this that we could argue may or may not be benefiting today's
right.
community and today's taxpayers.
So the big change that I think does benefit the taxpayer in terms of transparency is that these funds are now by law supposed to be 100% funded, where in the past, say they were 75% funded. We assumed there was going to be enough growth in the economy that whatever we pay in now is going to fund, you know, what our needs were basically 10 years ago of now who's retiring. And the group coming behind us, you know, incomes will go up. That pool of money will fully fund what we have in the system right now. And they funded that to about 75%. Now they have to fund to 100%. So I feel like the cost, from the taxpayer's perspective, what we're paying in now should be a full and real cost to support that system. Therefore, we can choose, is this a reasonable compensation package for the benefit of the public work that we're seeing done, period? If that's self-funding, then forever. At that point we decide, here's the entire package amount, here's what we're going to pay, is that worth the benefit that we're receiving in the road work, in the services, whether it's social services, public work services, infrastructure.
KINS News and Information Times, 8:42. We'll be back with more from Karen Dean.
What's the shopping show all about?
If you haven't listened to the show before, it's kind of tough to describe.
I guess the easiest first step is to simply go to the Shopping Show website.
TheShoppingShow.net.
And join us this Saturday for the next Shopping Show.
On KINS 106.3 FM.
KURY FM 95.3 and 101.3 in the Illinois Valley.
And KEKA 101.5 and 100.9 in Eureka. Good morning, KINS, News and Information Times, 8:47. We're back to Talk Shop this morning with Karen Diemer. Karen, the concept of labor negotiations, I guess, is kind of, I don't know, in my forefront. Maybe that's where the lobotomies happen. I don't know.
No.
The forefront of my mind, because we got the superintendent process going on today and yesterday.
Schools. Yeah.
Is labor law something that's that complicated for the rest of us to grasp or to know? Because what we've always heard is that if something is personnel related, it is quiet.
Mm-hmm.
It's not public. Mm-hmm. It's, and that's the one area of government that is not done in the public setting.
Right.
Does that hold true across the board with all labor negotiations for non-elected officials?
Right now, currently, in at least most of California, certainly in Arcata, it does. The public comes in two aspects. One is through the budget process, setting goals, helping the council set goals. What are the priorities that they want to see funded for the year? And then they set a budget to do that. That's going to include a labor component. The negotiation process happens in a closed session and in private, but the ultimate contracts are then reviewed by the public in open session before they're ratified. So, you know, that's where it comes out and says, we've got to be able to talk honestly. We're not professionals. A lot of us that come to the table in this, we have our employees sitting there with us. This is not what they do for a living. We've got to be able to talk freely, say things that we didn't mean to say in that particular way.
And sort of like arbitration.
Yeah.
In baseball, right? Where everybody takes everything personal and there's, yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So we've got to be able to work that out, come up with that common ground, and then say, okay, here's something we think both sides can support that meet the needs of the goals that are set out by the council this year. Now let's take that package out, share it with the community, and see if the community agrees as well before the council then ratifies it.
The amount of budget hearings I've gone to is probably, you know, under two handfuls.
Mm-hmm. That's probably more than
more than some, less
than
others.
Yeah.
But when the budget is released and discussed, do topics get talked about? All topics get talked about, or only if there's a question? Because I know part of the game is you hide things you don't want somebody to talk about. It's there if you find it. But you got to be able to find it on your own. We're not going to volunteer some of that information. Does that kind of describe in general the labor or employee compensation packages with budgets?
I would hope that doesn't describe either labor negotiations or the budget process in local government. We try to talk about everything. There's a lot that happens on any local government. So the way we budget is activity by activity. The council goes through goals through each department. What do they want to set? The department then creates a budget, and then we do go through that almost line by line. They're not overly attended meetings, but they are certainly transparent.
You know, free food will take care of that. Thanks for coming by. See everybody
Thank
on Monday.
You.